When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
So why are we still watching Quentin Tarantino films, even though he's become so problematic? If he wasn't supremely talented, it wouldn't be an issue. We could just dismiss him. But he creates this world that's so playful. It's so hard to resist a filmmaker who's like, let me delight you.
It's so iconic, you know, the outfit, the fact that it's going to potentially be revisited. It was so different. It was so violent. It was really funny as well. The soundtrack was super cool.
It is a peerless performance. I love me some Trinity in The Matrix. I love me some Sarah Connor. I love Ripley, but no one is working harder than Miss Thurman.
Hey everybody, welcome to this episode of Flix Watcher Podcast. Today, we are joined by Jess.
Hello.
Carrie.
Hello.
And Helen.
Hello.
And we're going to be talking about Kill Bill Volume 1.
Thank you, as always, to the mighty people for the mighty, mighty tunes. And thanks to Ben from Rockwood Audio for his awesome editing skills.
Please do remember to write a review and rate us on Apple Podcasts, anywhere you can do where you listen to the podcast, because it really does help us.
And you can join in the conversation with us on Twitter
at FlixWatcherPod and on Instagram
at FlixWatcher. Hello, film fans. Welcome to Flix Watcher Podcast. In our remote studio today, we have Jessica and Carrie. If you could please say hello and tell our listeners a little bit more about the podcast work that you do, please, Carrie.
Well, hello, everyone. I'm Carrie. I host and produce a podcast called Lights, Carrie, Action, and I do like 15-minute episodes reviewing three films through the lens of representation, storytelling, and nice cinematography, I guess. It's just me rambling, and you know, and people seem to like it, so that's nice.
What kind of how do you choose the films you have per episode? And three films per episode is for 50 minutes is pretty shocking.
It's pretty dense. Because I initially started it as there are so many films I had been meaning to watch, and I got pretty bored of saying that to people, being like, oh, that film, I've been meaning to watch that. So it started as a lockdown project, and then it just rolled with it. And then eventually, with the themes I was doing, I would do like a popular release, or like the new release, a popular, vaguely recent release, and maybe a classic. And normally when we go films, we try and be as diverse as possible. So like, I never really like an all-white male cast for like all of the films. I'm like, let's find other things. I feel like, you know, enough of those stories have been told. So
you're not working your way through the Wedding Crashers, or like, you know, you're not like a big Vince Vaughn gal.
No, absolutely not. I think I watched like 10 minutes of The Intern. Is that the one with Owen Wilson and Vince Vaughn? I was like, I feel like I've now just watched the whole film, or like the quality of the rest of the film. I don't really need to watch anymore. But yeah, and it's a lot of fun. It means I get to watch the films I've already been wanting to watch for years. So it's just been a fun passion project, and people seem to like it. So yay, it's a fun time.
And Jess, who are you? And tell us a bit about your podcast.
Oh, well, I am an actor and lately a writer, thanks to the podcast I do, which is Best Pick, where we, up until very recently, watched and assessed every Best Picture winner in no particular order. But we have now completed that task. So now we're looking at films from a variety of different angles. And we have a book coming out in the new year, February 15th, because we amassed an ungodly amount of research in 3.5 years. So yeah, it feels wonderful to have something tangible to do with that. I'm one third of the team. So obviously I'm with John Dorney and Tom Selinsky. They are my cohorts.
Yeah, John Dorney and Tom Selinsky have been on the show before, talking about Fargo. I can't remember what. Oh yeah, Midnight Run, I think, was Tom Selinsky's choice as well. So guys, if you want to listen to some of the Best Pick Pod crew members, then do listen out for those other episodes. It's a really good, it's a really fun show, and yeah, the amount of effort you guys put into each episode and research you do,
so naturally,
I think it lends itself to, you know, writing a book.
Thank
at the
you.
End of it. So well done, guys. It wasn't surprising. So it's like, yeah.
Oh, thank you so much. No, we've been really chuffed how people have taken it to their hearts, and you know, it's just great that people elect to listen to us, so we're not boring our loved ones. Like, it's definitely saved some relationships to have somewhere to put all this nerd, all this hardcore nerddom that we engage in.
Today we're talking about a film that was it Oscar nominated? I can't remember. We can talk about this in a second. But we're talking about Kill Bill Volume 1, which is your choice, Jess. Can you tell us first of all why you chose it, and then I'll bring the countdown up. And then you have 60 seconds to give a synopsis.
So I chose Kill Bill. I am a fan of Tarantino, even though that's a complicated thing and an ongoing conversation with myself. however, I revisit Kill Bill a lot, and I'm always astonished at how it holds up. I was also interested to revisit a film from like the early noughties, because if you're an 80s baby like I was, that was our 60s. Like, in a way, you know, like, that's looking back on it now, like, in my head anyway, if I was born in the 80s, there was the 60s 20 years before me, and I think about people born now, and like, it's a period film, even though it's sort of fantastical, and just how it holds up, and yeah, there's a lot of the complicated things to talk about, so, you know, yourself. But what it's about is, it's a very simple plot. It is basically, we discover the bride, who is a woman who was a member of the Deadly Viper Assassination Squad, and her mentor and the man who brought her on board and trained her up to be one of the world's deadliest assassins, or tried to kill her, tried to kill everyone she loved, and take a bloody, bloody revenge because she left him. And the film is about her doling out some payback. Five people have it coming. The remaining members of the Deadly Viper Assassination Squad and their leader, Bill. Hence the title, Kill Bill.
So I'd like to... Well, Jess, you said it. You have words with yourself about Quentin Tarantino. It seems to be a tricky relationship with a lot of people. Helen, I think you've got a tricky relationship with Quentin. What are your thoughts on Quentin and Kill Bill Volume 1?
So when this came out, I thought it was the best thing ever, and I loved it so much, and I thought Uma Thurman was amazing. I bought the soundtrack. I couldn't wait to get the DVD. I couldn't wait to see part 2. I saw it in the cinema. I thought it was the best. It was violent. The soundtrack was awesome. It was amazing. And then, was it in the last year or a couple of years ago, when the story came out about Uma Thurman's experience on set, with her being involved in the stunt car crash and Tarantino acting out some of the acts on her, it made me a bit uncomfortable. And kind of that and The Hateful Eight as well, my relationship with Tarantino has probably gone from being, he's so cool, like, his films are amazing, I love him, he writes really great female characters, to like, but why must you spit in their faces and punch them and be so violent to them all the time? So yeah, it's very complicated. So it was a very mixed experience coming back to Kill Bill Volume 1 for me personally. So yeah, that's me and Quentin.
Carrie, where do you sit with Quentin? I suspect you're a bit younger. Obviously, I'm not trying to throw shade on Helen and Jess and I, but I suspect you're a bit younger than ourselves. What's your relationship with Kill Bill?
Late 90s, baby.
How dare you? Get out.
Yeah, I have a difficult relationship with Tarantino. We went on one day and he never texted me back. It was a really heart-wrenching...
Classic Quentin.
...development. Yeah, classic Quentin. My feet weren't good enough for him.
I don't have very much.
Yeah, why not? He likes his
feet. He does love feet.
Yeah, that is a very common in joke. That, and I don't know if you were seeing like the press tour for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, but there was a question about Margot Robbie's screen time or the lack of lines she has in the film, considering she was such a prominent figure of I haven't watched Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. What decade is it set in?
60s, 69.
60s. It is 60s. Yeah. She was such an iconic figure in the 60s, and yet barely like appreciated her in the film. And in response to that question, Tarantino literally just said, I reject your hypothesis. And now I just say that in every conversation when people like try and roast me or call me out and be like, I reject your hypothesis. Yeah, I think like when I started knowing about Tarantino, this is showing my age. It was when like Inglourious Basterds was coming out, and when I was old enough, I was watching that with family, and I really enjoyed
with
that.
Family?
It is
oh,
Inglourious family classic.
But Inglourious Bastards is tremendous cathartic fun.
It is so great.
And the female characters in that are pretty phenomenal. I mean, the coolest character in the whole film is a woman, Elsa. You know, I think for me, I wanted to see how I felt revisiting it, because I don't think just because of the shitty behavior of a few men who should have known better, and I'm not even counting Harvey in that. That's a whole other level.
Oh yeah, like, I cringed when I saw them in the credits.
I'm talking about people who like aren't in prison, aren't serving sentences. I'm saying that you don't erase what Uma Thurman's achievement. You don't want to erase and wipe out what Uma Thurman did in cinema. And I think that for there to be a resurgence and a reappreciation. And what is particularly interesting is that what's happening now is the film is almost being echoed in real life. Quentin wants to direct another film about the bride, starring Uma and her daughter, who's exactly the right age now.
Is that Maya Hawke?
Yeah. So in a way, this line comes up again and again in Kill Bill. We have unfinished business, you and I. And I think that in a way, Quentin he's got to make his peace here. He's got to make it up to her. He's got to, you know, and I think it is on his mind. And his career has suffered from when he, you know, she left his life, essentially, because of the traumas she suffered. And it took years to process the trauma. I was looking at, like, press junkets they were doing at the time, and they were hugging for camera, and it was sincere and it was meant. And I think it took years for Uma Thurman to process what went down and what happened to her. But I don't think her achievement should be undermined or erased. Her incredible, peerless, I would say, performance. It is a peerless performance. I love me some Trinity in The Matrix. I love me some Sarah O'Connor or Sarah Connor, showing my nationality there. I love Ripley, but no one is working harder than Miss Thurman.
I think this is a lot of the problem, isn't it? With nominally cancel culture, or trying to you kick out a film or you kick out a project because of one person who's been badly behaved, the erasure of the other people involved. And you, as an actress, and you've worked in film and TV, there's hundreds of people involved, and it's almost gutting that one person has caused a whole film to be written off. I know Louis C.K., for example, I was really excited before we found out what a knobhead he was. I was really looking forward to a film that was coming out that he'd written
and
directed.
Was it The Secret Life of Pets?
No, that was not that good. I can't remember what the name of the film was, but because
it was called "I Love You, Daddy."
Yeah,
which I don't know if I was looking for. I don't know if I was looking
very
for.
Very poor
to
choice
honest,
of wording.
To kind of speak to your point, though, Kobe, I think for me, my issues are with Quentin, not so much the film. I don't think it's a film that hates women. I think I think you'd have to go a long way to find a film with such an incredibly strong, diverse female cast, which it has. And where they are complete badasses and incredible and nuanced and distinctive and all these things. What's the agenda of the film? And I think the agenda of this film was like, let's kick ass. Whereas I think the agenda of, say, of Woody Allen's catalogue is to genuinely plant this seed. It's not a big deal if she's 15. It's not a big deal if she is young enough to be your friend's daughter. It's not a big deal. We're all grown-ups. It's cosmopolitan. It's New York. We're bohemians. Like, that's kind of that's an agenda that bleeds through the material.
And that's completely true. And when we had Manhattan as one of the first films we talked about here, myself and Helen were like, I can't really deal with this. This is too much. But when we're talking about films like Kevin Spacey films, we see Kevin Spacey on screen, is like, do you want to erase American Beauty? You might do, depending on what your thoughts on the film. Do you want to erase Seven? Do you want to erase Usual Suspects? Because one person was a complete tool. And it's that... It's how far you go with that aspect. And I think, like, you're right, you're saying Kill Bill here is one of the best ensembles of female characters on screen kicking ass, even better so than, you know, the end of Endgame, spoilers, where all the women, all the female superheroes stand up randomly all together for no particular reason, apart from to say, hey, we're women here. But this is naturally like...
It's literally faux smash the patriarchy feminism. It doesn't literally nothing else. Yeah,
and here she
suddenly
really
we
does...
have rights now because everyone stands up. Wow.
I'll tell you, in this film, she smashes the shit out of the patriarchy. There are no dudes left.
100%.
So, yeah.
Just needed a bit of scalping. That solves everything.
Well, let's talk about the kills in Kill Bill, because this is one of the things that's leveled against the Kill Bill, particularly the first one, this one, is that it was very gory. I didn't, on rewatch, I didn't think it was that gory. I thought it was just hella cartoonish.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I was going to say. It's cartoonish. Like, it's not like, I think the most was when I was watching Volume 2, because I'd never seen Kill Bill. So I was like, I feel I would be ill-equipped if I hadn't seen both of them. So I feel like there's some details in Volume 2 that are worse than what happens in Volume 1, even though there's Absolutely. Way more, like, violence and in the first one. Like, it's just, yeah, as you said, it's cartoonish. It's like, you could probably just call it, like, a red waterfall rather than, you know, intestines spilling out. Like,
why are we still watching Quentin Tarantino films, even though he's become so problematic and issue-laden for us? If he wasn't supremely talented, it wouldn't be an issue. We could just dismiss him. But he creates this world that's so playful. And as I rewatched it this time, I was like, it's so hard to resist a filmmaker who's like, let me delight you. Like with the titles, you know, 13 Hours Later, with the gag about her name, you know, her name being kind of dubbed over with this sound cue. And her little nod to Mrs. Mia Wallace in Pulp Fiction when she goes very early on, she goes, would be about square. And that's basically going, hey guys, thanks for showing up here today. And it's a warm embrace, you know. But it's really interesting because he was very burned by the response to Jackie Brown, which I think is a stone cold masterpiece and a fiercely feminist film in lots of ways. And his best female character, I think, as well, in terms of kind of nuance. Well, I mean, it's between her and the bride, but at the same time, it's a real world character. So, yes. So he came to this film with a bit of a chip on his shoulder. And I think that manifested a lot in the onset behavior. Egos run wild, pressure, stress. But then there's still this really playful film that came out of it.
Helen, your thoughts on the gore of Kill Bill, Volume 1?
So I was rewatching it, and having recently rewatched Only God Forgives, like Kill Bill is like Disney compared to that. So I think like definitely gore levels have got more acceptable, maybe. Like you said, this is kind of like almost cartoony kind of gory. I think the worst part in it is quite early on with the rape scene is the most uncomfortable part. And even though I knew it was coming up, I couldn't remember it being as uncomfortable as maybe the first time round or the time that I saw it.
Well, it's a bit of a sleight of hand as well, because it's a bit like in Reservoir Dogs, you don't see the ear getting cut off and you don't see Uma Thurman being raped. It's alluded to. It's, we know that she has been. And I find it's a thing, you've never seen a woman be raped in a Quentin Tarantino film. You've seen a man being raped. You've never seen a woman being raped. Mm. And he does talk about how he uses violence the way a director would use slapstick in his mind. He does use rape and murder as plot devices. And the more unreal the world, I think the more okay that sits with us. But when it's, I find the violence in the end of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, I don't think this is a spoiler because there's a lot of violence in that film. Like that's because it's kind of set in a time and space that is memorable. It's shocking. Mm. Like it's not cartoonish as you say.
One big question we should ask: Kill Bill Volume 1 or 2? Jessica Comfort 2, Carrie.
So I think Volume 1 wins for like entertainment and like the dynamics, right? I think Volume 2 wins for script writing, like especially in like the last half an hour, 45 minutes. Like that's when I'm like, oh, I feel like I can't explain any further without that, alluding
that's
to a spoiler.
Sound.
But no, yeah. It gets very emotional.
Helen, one or two?
I've seen one the most, and I think the soundtrack for one is better than two. So I'm going to slightly go towards two, but I don't think two, sorry, I'm going to go, number one, and I don't think two is as bad as people remember it was. I think it's just the comparison of the two and maybe the gap, I would have quite happily watched them as one. I think I would have been prepared
they did
to
release,
see them in the whole film.
They did release in 2011, like, it as one whole thing, I think titled The Bloody Massacre, and it's literally the entire film, like, as a one thing, which I'd be interested in watching maybe at some point.
Is that different as literally just doing a double bill yourself of one and two?
Yeah, but in this way, studios make more money, Kobe. Come on.
I was saying they got one volume one, and then they got volume two, and then they got volume one and two together, and with a different name. Fine.
Yes.
I'm a volume two kid, I'd say. Yeah. I love the whole training with Pai Mei.
That really weird.
Oh, I love
it. I found it really unnaturalistically cartoonish, like, because everyone else is like a form of like character, whereas I felt like when watching that sequence it was like I was watching a Saturday morning anime. It was really
weird.
That's
probably what he wanted you to feel. I think that he's referencing different cinematic styles and actually for a guy who makes movies, he's a big TV guy, and lots of Kill Bill feels like TV. But we'll get to the small screen worth of it. I don't want to show my hand too soon. But I think that he is it Takeshi Kitano?
Yeah.
I think really inspires him as well in terms of the quickness of the fights. I mean, the Crazy 88 sequence, that goes on and on. But the kind of when the murders are very quick, they're very sudden and rapid and brutish. The actual slayings with Vermita Green in the beginning, this epic knife fight. But the actual kill is it's one second of a bad decision. It's one second of dropping the ball. That's when you take your shot, and that's quite consistent throughout. And I do love that. I do think that that keeps you surprising, you know.
One of my favorite things is the fight with Oren. One, I think I watched that scene before in like a media studies class, so I already like knew vaguely what happened in it. But I heard the music, the track after, the Flower of Carnage, and I was like, I have heard that before, and it's really annoying me where it is. And then I found out it was from the film Lady Snowblood, which is a fantastic samurai film from 1973. And I was like, classic Tarantino referencing a samurai film, like, oh, just bringing it all back to samurai. I was like, wow, for once I feel cultured.
He does want to give you treats, you know. He wants to give you goodies. He wants to give you treats. He's a kid in a candy store, and he wants you to come along and have fun, you know. And I think it's interesting. Like, I think actually the character in Leonardo DiCaprio's character in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, I think that there's echoes of Tarantino in him, in his kind of boyish stubbornness. And then there's a kind of a maturing, because I saw him giving a talk in London, and it was a very mellow man that sat before you, a very mellow, surprisingly humble dude on that stage that I was in double denim looking like a dad, you know. It was like, oh, you've chilled the hell out and you've had a word with yourself. Okay. I see that now. And as he was, you know, doing the podcast circuit to promote his book about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, he was kept on bringing up this idea of like doing that's the film left, that's the unfinished business. So I hope we reconvene again to discuss.
Yeah,
I'd be interested stylistically what changes, because I feel like post Me Too there's going to be some changes in terms of like writing style or the interactions.
Guys, let's head to the scores.
Hello folks, I'm Sam.
And I'm Martin.
And every week for the last 5 years, we've got together to talk about the musician Tom Waits.
He's a gravelly voice singer that sounded like he doused his vocal cords in bourbon and set fire to them with a cigarette and wrote such classic songs as Way Down in the Hole, Downtown Train, Jersey Girl.
He's also the gravelly-voiced actor from films such as The Ballad of Buster Scruggs and Seven Psychopaths, both of which, coincidentally, are on Netflix, and both of which Kobe and Helen have discussed here on FlixWatcher.
So make sure you check those episodes out, and when you have a little bit of a taste for the magic that is Tom Waits, why not head over to songbysongpodcast.com or search for Song by Song in your podcatcher of choice to listen to a little bit more about Tom Waits.
So the FlixWatcher scores are out of 5. You may have decimal places if you wish. And we will start with you, please, Jess, with your recommendability.
5. I think it's a culturally iconic moment. And I remember coming out of the cinema, I was about 21 or, no, 23 maybe, 22, 23, I can't remember. Anyway, early 20s, and I came to the cinema and I was so adrenalized and I couldn't understand why. And it was because I had viewed this roller coaster ride through the lens of a woman, you know, and I felt part of the fun in a way I didn't with Fight Club. And I love Fight Club, but like, you know, I was like, oh, we have our Fight Club. It's mine. It's my time now. So I for that kind of coming out literally like buzzing and electrified, I think it's important. I think it is an essential part of your cinema history. And listen, if it's not for you, I think it's still worth a look. It's still fascinating. It's still interesting.
Carrie.
Jess, you're going to hate me.
No, I'm not. He's divisive. And like, you'll get no argument there.
I personally would give it a 3 for recommendability. I feel like if you want to watch, as Jess said, an iconic piece of cinema and want to know about Quentin Tarantino's filmography, I'd be like, yeah, cool, Kill Bill's great. Would I suggest it when friends are over and they're like, oh, we want to watch an action film? I probably would think about other things. I would probably think Inglourious Basterds, but I am happy that I watched it.
You know, for a party hang film, you can't go wrong with Inglourious Basterds, like, because it's just
sort of episodic.
Yeah, and it's like, it's very good.
I think, I don't know, if I was bringing QT out of a party, I think Kill Bill would be very good because there's a lot of action that happens in it and the visuals are striking. But for me, the power in Inglourious Basterds is the dialogue. Like that scene at the start with Christoph Waltz in the old cottage thing. There's a better name than the cottage, but that scene, there's very little action in it, but it's still terrifying. And I couldn't imagine stopping a party and say, guys, let's watch this bit. But
Kobe, you've forgotten how, because there's dialogue heavy scenes, there is space for us to roast people in it. Like being like, oh yeah, this guy's turned up again.
Christoph Waltz.
Yeah. When I'm the kind of person in a social circle that when we watch a film, we are always trying to make jokes and make each other laugh. So it's even better if there are like heavily scripted scenes, because it just means we can just make fun of other things in the meantime. Just gives us space.
And the entire reason I do a podcast with Tom and John is that we do not speak a word during films. It's like the complete opposite.
This is the thing about me, about cinemas reopening now. I've forgotten in that 18 months that when people speak, it makes me want to literally pick them up and throw them out of anywhere and stop them.
The terror I feel when I open a bag of whispers is unlike any other.
Yeah, Kobe's coming for you. He's coming for you, Carrie.
I will.
Better watch out.
I have a special set of skills. Helen. Sorry, your recommendability score.
So I think I was probably the same as you, Jess, when I saw it at the cinema and came out. The performance that Uma gives in this is such a physical performance. And also kudos to Zoe Bell, who's her stunt double in this. The two of them together are just fantastic. And there are some bits that I feel maybe have aged a little bit. That some of the kind of like animation feels a bit like maybe unnecessary or a little bit of its time, but it's Uma's film. And even though my relationship with Quentin is very up and down, I can't take it away from the fact that it's so iconic, you know, the outfit, the fact that it's going to potentially be revisited. It's one of those films that it was so different. It was so violent. It was really funny as well. The soundtrack was super cool. I'm going to give it a 4.5.
That's amazing. And listen, I would say as well, I love that you said it's Uma's film, because don't forget, she came up with the story with Quentin, you know, as when they were on breaks, as filming Pulp Fiction, they kept kicking about this idea about a bride and like a bride who's like covered in blood, and just that image kept on coming to them. So, and it is like, he does say story by Q and you, you know, so it's just the performance. It is, she's a co-creator of the whole concept. And on set, they fought like cats and dogs, you know. The relationship didn't go sour with the car. I think the car was the culmination of a lot of things that had been bubbling under, because she said, I know the world is cartoonish, but I have to bring the humanity to this. And that wasn't on the page. Otherwise, she's just, you know, a woman who kills 5 people. So I think that, yeah, exactly what you're saying. It's Uma's film, and for Uma.
Yeah, I'm going to go 4.5 as well. I think it's a must-see Quentin Tarantino film. I think it's actually one of the easiest watches as well, even though it is ostensibly the bloodiest, probably.
And probably the longest.
Is it the longest?
Well, I mean, no, because it's divided into two, it's actually got more brevity than more bloated efforts such as Hateful Eight or Once Upon a Time in America, you know? It feels defter than those efforts, you know, even though ultimately put it all together. Yes, it's like, you know, Gone with the Wind. But yeah, it's reading its own. To me, I found it went really quickly, you know, today as well.
Yeah, I found that as well. And also that the annoying thing that Netflix does, it has part one, but not part two.
I was very lucky that there was a DVD of Kill Bill Volume 2 lying around in my house.
Oh, yeah, I'm just going to have to watch Volume 2 again. I don't know what they're missing out on, a massive trick, I think, Netflix.
Wild, truly wild, guys. Sort it out.
Repeat viewing score, Jess.
I'm going to go 4 because there are some real twists and surprises. Now, I have to say, I am still unearthing little gems, little moments, little things that pass me by. Little fixes, little tricks. So that's why 4, I think, is pretty high in terms of rewatchability. But when you don't know, particularly the bombshell at the end, when you do not know what's coming, and it's so fresh and bracing and new, I've got to just dock 1 because you do lose something from not knowing what's coming next.
What bombshell, sorry?
The bombshell at the end of Volume 1. Does she know her daughter is still alive?
Yes. Sorry, of course. Yeah. Genius way to finish. Carrie, rewatchability.
I would give it a 4 as well, because it's one of those things that I might not actively recommend it to people, but if I'm hanging out at someone's house and they're like, oh, do you want to watch Kill Bill? I'm like, yeah, actually, let's just give it a go. Let's give it a whirl. Like, I would happily, if suggested, would watch it again and would be happy to find, as Jess said, like hidden gems to pick up on.
Even today, her reaction to discovering that her belly isn't pregnant, I had never really, that hadn't impacted on me. That impacted me in a way much differently as a woman in her late 30s and life, you know, than like a 21-year-old. Like, I just was floored by that. And because she was blowing whistles and complaining about Weinstein, they didn't market her as best actress as they should have, you know. So she was thwarted on that front as well. But yeah, so you do, I mean, I've seen it like so many times, and I did, even just today, I was like, oh, I never clocked that before.
Helen, repeat viewing score.
Yeah, I mean, Tarantino is one of those people who, he makes his films like rewatchable, like junk food, really, isn't it? It's basically like, you could just shovel it in, you're like, yeah, I'm loving this. And then at the end, you're like, where did 2.5 hours go? Like, oh, won't do that again. And then you see it's on and you're like, oh, give me that. There's things, because you like being able to kind of quote along, or you know bits are coming, or you learnt something new, or you watch the film that he's kind of like stolen a bit from, and you're like, oh, I know where that's from now, I'm really clever. That's what he does to you with all of his films, and that's why you watch them again and you're like, oh, I know now. And you're like, oh, I know where this is actually from, you don't need to tell me. That's what he does to you. So yeah, I'll go with the 4 club in this one for repeat viewing.
Yeah, let's go for a 4. Let's do the 4 party. I haven't seen Hateful Eight yet because it just, on the outset, just seems too long. No. When I do watch it, How long is it again? It's like 3.5 hours or something like that.
It's one for the completists. I'm allergic.
Yeah, no, it's one for the completists sitting right here. Like, yeah. And I totally get, like, I have close friends who are like, I hate that film. Fuck that film. And I'm like, I'm not mad at you for holding that opinion. I still like it, because I clearly have a problem and some sort of codependency issue with this man. But, you know, there's still bits that I love. And also, it was great to see Tim Roth back in a Tarantino joint. So, yeah.
I think the way it's marketed with an intermission, I was like, nah.
You're like, you lost me at intermission, dude.
Yeah.
What do you think this is? Gone with the Wind?
Exactly. It's in the 1930s.
It is not.
I think I'd be upset if you did watch it. I'd be like, I told you. I warned you. You had the warning. But I think you're not going to go there. So
ostensibly, I will watch it at some point. It's just, you know, I've got other things to do. I don't know what my point was there with the repeat viewing score. There's his films. I think up until Django, I could happily rewatch all of his films at any point in time. Someone just dropped it on, I'd rewatch them. But Django onwards, I'm like, I don't really want to watch Django again. Once Upon a Time Hollywood, yeah, I quite enjoyed it, but watch it again, I don't know. But this is on the side of, yeah, happily rewatch at any point. And I'm including True Romance in this as well. Yeah, it's a great film, and he layers it together. As Jess says, it's things that you pick up in each rewatch, and that is part of his masterstroke in early QT. Let's go to small screen score. Jess?
I'm going to say 4. Like, undoubtedly, you lose a little bit in the House of Blue Leaves sequence on the small screen. Mm. But actually, it works really well on television. It's not like, it's not an obstacle. There's some dodgy, particularly in this sequel, actually, so I don't know if this is helpful, but like there are moments of like dodgy back projection and where things are meant to look a bit cheap.
On the plane.
Oh, exactly, on the plane. Now, that works incredibly well on the small screen. It kind of looks like a slicker choice, like a more artistic choice than a kind of a jarring moment. So there are parts of it that really lend itself. This man loved his television so much growing up, and all those influences are there. So it works really well. The budget was meant to be 30 million for both films, and it ultimately was 55 million, and everyone was like, this is out of control. And looking back, that was a bargain. Those two films for 55 million, pretty special. So the kind of cut and shot bits of it, I think, work really well on the small screen. So 4.
Carrie?
I'm going to give it a 2 because I think the absolute, as someone who watched it for the first time, I could just feel the complete benefit if I watched it on a big screen. I mean, watching it on my TV was great. It would be dreadful on like a laptop or an iPad, in my opinion. But I think if my first experience was in a cinema, preferably with a bunch of friends, like having popcorn and just watching all the blood spill on people's faces, I feel like it would have been great. So I don't know if I would necessarily get that on like a phone. So I'm going to give it a 2.
Helen?
I'm going to give it a 3. It's fine watching on a TV if you've seen it before, but the experiences I've had have never matched that first time in the cinema with an audience really kind of cheering and like, oh, this is great. And the soundtrack for me was immense. That was one of the big moments for me. The soundtrack experience in the cinema.
Yeah, Karen Rockman. I'm not sure if she did Kill Bill, but she did Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction. And she, Tarantino owes her a lot, man. Those music cues, you know, in his films. Like, she's doing the Lord's work for Tarantino a lot of the time. I'm pretty sure it was Karen, still Karen Rockman. And it was still Sally Menke as well, like one of his first, his original editor, you know, who's the closest he said he ever had to like a true collaborator.
Oh. Good for him. Sorry, is that 4, Helen?
3.
I'm going to go for. I don't think I've seen it in the cinema. I'm sure I would have remembered it if I had. I had this thing with Quentin where I always kind of went, "No, it's not going to. It's not going to repeat himself again. It's not going to get better." And I was like, "Oh shit!" I watched it on DVD. I was like, "Yeah, it's better than the previous one." Or I should have watched it in the cinema. I think it was in that phase, and then I rescinded for Inglourious Basterds. So I don't think I did, but I think I've had a good time on the small screens each time. If it came on at the Prince Charles Cinema, I had 2.5 hours to kill. Yeah, why not? I'll pop in there. And that gives, what's that score for me? 3.5, I think. Engagement score. Jess?
I don't think you can really turn this film off when you started it. Almost particularly if you've seen it before, because you're like, I'll just wait until the hospital, but I'll just wait until another fight. So I'm going to give it 4.5 for engagement. If you were turned off by violence, by the way, it's a minus 7,000. Like, you know, if you were squeamish, if you don't like blood, and if you don't like bone crunching violence, like, you're gonna, this is not for you. Don't stick around.
But if that doesn't faze you.
Yeah.
Once you've recommended it, then it's like, okay.
Yeah,
that's one of the questions you ask them, surely. Do you like blood, or are you turned off massively by blood or fake?
And don't ask that on a date, but yeah, ask that about this film. 4.5 for engagement.
Engagement. Carrie?
I said 4 because the only time I would stop it is if I'm in a rush. I'm like, I should leave now, but I want to watch the rest of it. But I would have to pause it and then come back probably when I'm home. But I don't think I would have the nerve to stand my ground and watch the rest of it, sadly.
Helen?
Yeah, I'll give 4.5 as well. It feels short compared to the Quentin Tarantino films that kind of came after that are pushing them all to 2.5 hours. So yeah, this kind of zips along mostly because you want to get through the kill list. And I think then with volume two, that's probably why it's not my favourite, because the kill list killing off stopped a bit and we went back to the backstory. So yeah, 4.5.
I think I'm going to give 5 here. And I should say, mainly because this is only my second time watching it, so I'd forgotten a lot of what happens. I forgot about how Vinita was killed at the start through to the bombshell at the end. So I was like hooked, and I did have to stop it. And each time I paused it or stopped it, I was like, oh, goddamn, I need to get back to this ASAP. So yeah, 5. And that gives an overall score of 3.96875, just under 4.
Ooh!
Where it lost small screen score, lost a bit there, but that's fair. That's cutie. Guys, should we head to Twitter? If you're listening for the first time, or if you haven't joined us yet on Twitter, we are at FlixWatcherPod on Twitter, and do follow us because we put a shout out before each episode that we record, and gives you the opportunity to hear your voice, or well, hear your words as read out by our guests on the show. Look out for tweets like this. We're chatting Kill Bill Volume 1 with Carrie Jomo from Lights Carry Action, and it's Jess Regan from at Best Pick Pod. Have you seen it? Tells you score and review out of 5 stars for a shout out. And we've got a few responses here. Jess, do you have Twitter in front of you?
Okay, so now Lee Thomas, I know that name. He says, my favourite cutie, fun, inventive and gory, already iconic. Thank you, Lee. Very much my feeling too.
I like to add for Lee Thomas's tweet, already iconic, babe. It is iconic. It's 18 years old. At this point, it's old enough to cement iconic. That there's the social boundary there.
Semantic.
Yes. We have Liam H. Dempsey's tweet saying, my favourite of the two volumes, a relentless roaring rampage of bloody revenge makes for a samurai action masterpiece. Uma is iconic and QT's dialogue is as sharp as ever, but stripped back to let the action take centre stage beautifully. 5 stars.
And Helen, last one.
Recent guest, David Trumbull. Ushering in the hyper-stylized second act of his career, Tarantino graduates to bigger budget filmmaking with the sharpness of a Hattori Hanzo sword. Frankly, works better as a standalone than a volume one, but that only speaks to its rewatchability. Oh, and Thurman kills. 5 stars.
Nice. Carrie and Jess, can you sign off by letting everyone know where we can find you online, and we'll say sayonara to the listeners.
So, listeners can find me at It's Jess Regan on Twitter. Please do give us a follow. I tweet lots of film stuff and updates about our podcast. You can find us at Best Pick Pod on Twitter as well. And you can email us at bestpickpod@gmail.com if you have a listen and you'd like to share some thoughts with us. And if you send us a particularly nice email, it might get read out.
Carrie.
You can follow the podcast Instagram at Lights Carry Action. Just basically lets people know when shows are out. And you can follow my Twitter at Carrie Jomo, and it's mainly me trying to be me and funny. If you want to boost my ego, that'd be absolutely lovely. And also, yeah, I have a personal Instagram, Carrie Jomo, as well, which is mainly just pictures of my dog. So if you like any of those, catch me there.
And guys, obviously you listen to podcasts, so you like other podcasts, you like film podcasts, Best Pick Pod, Lights Carry Action. Go there, type in your podcast app that you listen to right now, and say hello to Carrie and Jess. Thank you so much for spending time with us, guys. It's been great talking about Kill Bill Volume 1.
It's been awesome. Thank you so much, guys. Thanks a million.
Thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me. It's been fun.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Enjoyed this episode of FlixWatcher Podcast? Why not leave us a 5-star review on iTunes? You can also follow us at FlixWatcherPod on Twitter, and we're at FlixWatcher on Instagram. Thanks as always to the Mighty People for their mighty, mighty tunes, and Ben from Rockwood Audio for his awesome editing skills. If you're looking to get your podcast edited as sweet as this, get in touch with Ben, and that's Rockwood, R-O-K-K, Wood Audio. Tell him FlixWatcher sent you.
You just heard a Stripped Media production.